and it sits there with me because that drives me, because I know that day I could have done more and I didn't.
Welcome, Mitchell Smith, to the Confidence Credentials couch. I'm really, really pleased to have you on. I'm really looking forward to this. Like we ask all our guests at the start, what I want to know from yourself is, what does confidence mean to you personally?
I think confidence is all about being happy in yourself, mentally and physically, and in your surroundings. And for me, it's about having the belief and the ability to achieve something that you want to achieve.
I like that. Now, I know your backstory, so we're going to cover off many things here. From your career start as a leather builder at Vegas, and words in your wheel. There's fitness in there, there's walking, there's your motorbikes, there's many different things. So I'm really looking forward to covering up all these topics. But we've spoke to a couple of guests recently where they've had big career changes, including myself and Dave as well. Talk me through how it all started early on. A younger Mitchell starting off in work, wow. A leather go apprentice to work in your wheel, working for big PLC.
Yeah, so sensible school life. I didn't really know what I wanted to do in leather school. I think like a lot of people at that age, got offered, I think it was four jobs at the time, age 16. Three of them were in the shipyards. The other one was being leather go apprentice, traveling around in the van. That seemed far more attractive than being based in the shipyards every day. It was with GEC, UK's biggest employer at the time, I think. My father wanted me to get an apprenticeship. GEC were offering a fantastic apprenticeship with college-based learning and everything else, only with HMCs it was called in the time, and teaching that right. So I did. First 6 months we spent subcontracting back in the shipyards. So I ended up based in the shipyards where I didn't want to be. Learned lots of things from that. And then I guess you just work with different people and different experiences and you start to understand. I think very early on what I didn't want to do, I still today don't know what I want to do, but I started early on realizing what I didn't want to do. And I watched different people. I used to come home filthy, dirty from being leather go apprenticeship. And I thought to myself, do I really want to be doing this when I'm 50-year-old? I watched some of the guys I worked with who were 60-year-olds still doing it, thinking, I really don't want to be doing that. I need to progress somehow. So I started to learn different things. Worked my way through being an estimator, planner, engineer, contract manager, export manager. Joined all sorts of companies I worked for were bought and sold. I moved around and changed jobs, did all sorts of things. Fabulous career. Really, I've enjoyed just about all of it. Been challenged at times, hard work, but really exciting. And I got to the point where I think I was responsible for over 3,000 people, 200 million turnover business in the PLC, sitting on a board of directors. And I decided one day it wasn't for me. About 12 years ago, I'd done all sorts of things in between. And I decided I want to work for myself. I met a management consultant many years ago who I admired enormously, and I thought that's what I want to do. So I decided to leave that job and go and work for myself. So one day I was responsible for thousands of people. The next day I'm building my own desk, my own office, looking after myself. And I decided that day I would never employ anybody else because I didn't want the responsibilities to employing somebody else. And I just worked for myself, primarily so I could earn what I wanted to earn, but also so I could have a lifestyle I wanted, so I could be more flexible with my job, and I could enjoy my career more. Now, still to this day, I haven't employed anybody. I've been doing it for 12 years, and I've probably just done it.
That's a big step to be around that many people, that much responsibility. How did you find the transition from going from working for a PLC, 3,000 people, to returning to a bit of turnover, to ultimately on your own, organized?
I guess, like most things in my life, I've done a bit of planning and preparation beforehand, so it wasn't... jumping straight from one to one the next day. I had organized, I had some contracts lined up ready, so I'd work on day one. So I wasn't starting on day one, I knew what I was doing. I think one of the biggest challenges, and what a good friend of mine said to me, I think you'll struggle doing that, Mitchell, because you like being involved in teams. and you like being part of a team. And when you work in a big company, you're more involved in different teams every day. And now I'm on my own, and I was responsible for everything on my own. But what I suddenly realized was, because I was helping different businesses, and I'm now not executing several businesses, I'm actually part of their teams. So whilst I'm on my own, in my own business, and responsible for my own life, I am part of other people's teams, and I get involved in their team on a professional level. So I've still got that team ethic and absolutely involved, but I can also set relationship with them to work something. I can do both.
The thing from kind of, I just know from my experience when I've got a similar background, maintenance apprentice, when I was 16, but I was around different functions. I was working in the steel foundry at the time. And it was fairly brutal for a little 16-year-old. So I remember to go into that. And I would say I was confident-ish. You know, I had a good mix. My dad was playing cricket, so I would have parties. So I'd plenty of people around us. But you go into that environment where, excuse my terminology, some hairy arse guys with big hammers and stuff like that, and having to work alongside them. I mean, that was great life experience back then, and give me a lot of confidence going on, you know, when I moved on in my career. From your side, moving around in those departments in the early years, would you say that really give you the confidence to kind of move on into the world of working for big corporates, but also in your personal life as well?
Yeah, huge. I have worked with all sorts of characters. When you're on building sites, as I was, and you meet some real characters, and you have to learn how to learn from them, but also understand them and interact with them on the right level. I think prior to that, I played a lot of golf as a youngster. And when you're playing golf, you're not just playing with people your same age, you're playing with people who are older. And some of my father's friends played golf, and I played with them. So you mix with different ages, so that helped a lot. You then get into work and you mix with all sorts of people from all sorts of walks of life, and then that's massive life experience. Really, you can learn from I've always thought you can learn from everybody you meet, and you've got I like watching people and understanding how people act and how they react, and trying to take all that on board and get the best bits from it is really important. Like, it helps you outside of work as well, of course, because you'll learn how to interact with different people in different ways.
Your negotiation skills are there early on when you haven't worked with the other departments, because you haven't worked with, you know, ultimately your partners at work, it's different departments as well, to try and get whatever you need to do your own job as well. So there's some great life experience there being around other teams coming out of that, which no doubt you've carried forward in your personal and professional life.
You need different cultures and different businesses. And you're interacting as a tradesman, as I was at the time, you're interacting with different trades, and some people let you do things, some people don't. And you've got to use those negotiation skills to get the job done. And everybody's it's a big build site, it's a big team. And everybody's got to work together to finish something. Some people are committed to working together to get it finished, others are definitely not. Then you've got to use your skills to try and get everybody to make your job easier and help them with their job as well, but without taking over their job. And that's a real delicate balance at work. And that just transcends life time, because you've got to work with different people who have different thoughts from you, who are thinking differently, who are brought up differently, it's just different people. It's people skills. It's what it's all about. Really, it is.
That must have massively helped when you decided to grow out on your own in the career change that you did, to pass on that knowledge to other leadership teams. Because I think we all think we know everything, but in fact, we sometimes know very little. How do you find that? How did you find working with ultimately your customers and taking them through your experiences to help them improve? Did you have any sort of challenges, barriers to kind of get over that with your customers?
Yeah, I think if I take it back a bit first, I had to do that for myself first. So it's quite a lonely world running a business. And I met a managing consultant many years ago, and he helped me with my business. And I didn't think he was going to be able to, but he did. It was brilliant because he was there to be able to help me. If you're running your own business, you can't talk to your friends, your family, your wife, your partner about the business because it's your private business. So having somebody to help and to lead on is really important. I think through my early career, I had a bit of imposter syndrome going on. I'd been like an apprentice, and all of a sudden I'm running big teams and being a senior person in the business, and I'm thinking, who am I to be doing this? I didn't go to Oxford or Cambridge. Why should I be doing this? And a lot of that went through my head early days. So I took myself back to university, did a master's degree. And a lot of the stuff I learned, of course, I learned lots of new skills. Of course, I did. But a lot of it, I learned the names for some of the things I'd already been doing where I thought I was winging it. And I learned to have some confidence that what I'd been doing at that point was actually right. In most cases, I did learn some things that were wrong as well, by the way. And that helped a lot when you came later on in life. And I'm going into other people's businesses. And I think one of the biggest things you can help people with in their business is passing on that experience. Now, I always say to people, if you want to learn about how to do all this, you can go and buy all the books you want and read them. But instead, why not talk to somebody who's been through it before? And if you've grown a business, as I have done a few times, you can pass that knowledge on very quickly, and you can take people through the steps of that and also help them with those hurdles, because it's like a glass ceiling every day to them. So all of a sudden, it's the first time we've done £1 million in a year. Very soon, it's the first time we've done £1 million in a month. And if you run your own business, that's really difficult the first time you get there. Employing new staff, changing your team structure, growing your business, entering new markets, all of that is difficult if you've never done it before. And if you can borrow that knowledge of somebody else, that really helps.
And also, it's a very lonely place. And I think not just, you know, men running their own businesses, but I think we find it quite difficult when we're in a situation, and I don't mean loneliness by not having people around us, you know, because you can have, you know, those lonely points when you've actually got a lot of people. You can be, like whether you are a wife, you work colleagues, but still be in a really lonely place because of the reasons that you mentioned before, not being able to talk openly to others. Yeah. And I think that's one of a real big challenge now that men face. What advice have you got? How have you overcome those moments of loneliness in business to really help you?
I work with a management consultant who helped me in my business. And as I say, when he first walked in, I thought, what on earth is he going to be able to do in my business? Talking new at the time, because he doesn't know my industry. But within days, he helped me improve my business because he knew lots of transferable skills that would improve my business. What he did, first of all, was build some trust with me. So I trusted him and trusted his opinions. And I try and do that with everybody I work with. Trust's massively important. Again, if I want them to open up to me and tell me some confidential things about the business that's not going well, or they've got a challenge with, they've got to be able to trust me that they can do that in confidence, and I'm not going to tell the whole world about their business problems. So you've got to build that trust first of all, and then get into those challenges and help them through. A lot of it's hand-holding, because a lot of times they know the answers to the issues. And it is a very lonely place when you're running your own business. And if you can help them walk through that and see the other side of that, that helps them in their world.
That translates across to your personal life as well, though, isn't it? Just then finding that person or the people around you that you get woken up to. Because I think we all know the answers, but it takes some coaxing out. You know, it's just some being there for somebody, asking those questions and somebody to listen. But, you know, from a personal and business point of view, it's very difficult sometimes having that first conversation or finding the right people to have that discussion with, because it is difficult to have that discussion with your partner or your friends. So really that circle of friends and colleagues around you must be vital.
It is, yeah. And I think back to the business thing, that's why I mentor people and help them through their business, but I've also got people who mentor me from my business who've been through the same thing. So they help me through those challenges, and so therefore I'm not in a lonely world in business. I can talk to them as well about business, and they can help me with my challenges. I've also got a great friendship group, which a lot of us have known each other since school days. I've got two other sisters who are fabulous, and I've got some other people in my life who I love, who are really good, look after me, and know how to get, I was going to say the best out of me, but know how to get things out of me that I probably wouldn't normally share. So they'll know the right moments, they'll know the right environment, they'll know the right places to take me, to make sure I talk. One of my friends would talk to me in a pub on a different level, then we'll go off for a walk together, and he'll absolutely not stop till he gets it out of me. and he has to try hard some days, I must admit, but he does, and he knows he does have to do that. And I do stuff with him as well, and we share stuff together, and that's magical when that happens, actually. It really is.
I'm interested, I mentioned at the start of the podcast in the intro, not just about your career, but you walking, hiking, mountain climbing, your fitness. When did that, were you always a kind of active, athletic, fit person from childhood, or was there a tipping point in life where you thought, you know what, I really need to change my lifestyle here?
More than that. So at school, I played football, some teams and things. I played a lot of golf when I was younger, but I wasn't really massively active. I did some outdoor stuff, some boys brigades and things like that. I enjoyed it, but I wasn't massively into it. Early days for me was all about music, and when you get to 18 or 19, it was all about going out for a drink and having a good social life. Actually, one of the first reasons I got into it was back to work. So faced with a problem at work or faced with a challenge at work, I discovered that if I took myself off on the hills for a couple of hours, I could solve it. So I then got into this pattern of thinking, if I was at work doing something during the week, I had a big presentation to do next week to somebody, or I had a big challenge, I used to say to myself, leave it or something, leave it there and pick it up on Sunday. I used to take myself off on the hills on a Sunday, no pen and paper or anything with me, but I just used to go on my own, off on the hills. By the time I'd walk up a hill, back down a hill, I'd solve. Come back, made a load of notes and think, right, I've got this problem. So it became my thinking space, away from everybody else, how to find some time alone, how to think, how to solve. And that's what it then became very cathartic. Like I could find my way through just about anything by taking myself on the hills, and the hills just got bigger as the problems get bigger, and on it goes. It's probably later in life that I've got into it far more. I didn't run when I was younger, probably couldn't run, but I couldn't run very well. I only started running to get fit so I could do more walks. I then started doing challenge walks with the coast to coast and then all sorts of walks.
Can I just ask, if you don't mind, what sort of age that was? I think it's important that...
Mid-40s. So I was overweight I was early career, back to running national businesses, traveling all over the country. I'm working in different parts of the country every day.
Fry breakfast in the morning.
Fry breakfast, little chef every morning. business lunch every day. 2 whisper bars in the car and we're at the next meeting. Hotel on me on at night, took to 3-course meal because that'll keep us amused. A couple of pints. I put weight on, and I put a lot of weight on. Became very inactive, realized I needed to do something about it. And that's when I got, so it was mid-40s, about then. Started really getting into it and heavily into it, running again, walking, and then started taking stuff on more and more extreme hill challenges.
So when you say extreme hill challenges, I think I kind of like on the edge it a little bit. Can you just take us through some of the challenges that you've done? Talk us through some of the not so much hills that you've climbed, but tell me a little bit about that.
So one of my friends will disown me if I don't mention Nepal within the first 10 minutes, because I mention it everywhere I go, so I'll mention Nepal in a second. And Everest, because you've got to mention that as well, because that's got to go in every conversation, obviously. So I've done stuff in the UK, obviously. I've done lakes and lots of walks on the lakes. Done all the Scottish stuff and been around Wales, done all of that. beat the Alps, so I've done the Alp, a few hills in the Alps around Switzerland and Mont Blanc, Europe's highest accessible mountain, as it was at the time during all the COVID stuff. And done various climbs, done some winter climbing or ice climbing. And in 2020, I put myself off in Nepal. I was going to go with a friend of mine. I ended up going on my own, which was a bit of a strange thing to do at the time, but I decided to go on my own. Met some great people. So really, the first day there, just met some people who were there on their own. Got on my house on fire. Had a great time in terms of conversation and things. Had a really challenging time. We took ourselves off from Walk Everest Base Camp. It sounds like a bit like a walk, but it's a hell of a challenge. And exploring Nepal, lived in some atrocious conditions for a few weeks. And I mean atrocious conditions. And came back. Sort of a real taste for it. Went back to the Alps again. And then last year, I went back to Nepal. We did five big hills, as I call them, our mountains. So we went around and did a few, did about 6,500 meters of Meerut Peak. And spent days upon days in minus 18 degree temperatures and all sorts of horrendous. And I was saying, somebody asked me the other day, what's it like? It's really difficult and challenging, obviously. It's very technical. And also, the biggest part about it is the mental bit in your head. It's physically exhausting because you're surviving on food, which is not very good. And Snickers bars, which are very good. And you're surviving in accommodation, which is probably, you probably wouldn't let your dog sleep in some of them. It's garden shed type accommodation, minus 18 outside, about minus 70 inside. When I first went, I thought to myself, well, I can manage minus 18 degrees. So being in Scotland, when it's minus 10, it's not, it's only a few degrees colder. It's not bad. I can manage that. But of course, when you're in Scotland at minus 10, you go out for the day, you come down, you go back to the hotel, you get home, you have a nice meal, pint, and you're all right. In Nepal, you go out minus 18, you sleep in minus 18, and for 3 days, I couldn't feel my toes, so on my fingers, I lost the feeling, so on my fingers for weeks. I had to have a Sherpa tie me sticks and axes on my hands in the morning because I couldn't feel all that type of stuff. It is really a fabulous experience. It is absolutely life-changing. The people out there are so humble and beautiful, and they live in absolutely poor conditions, but they're happy every day. And to watch that is amazing, because you come back to this country and you see people, you know, complain about the holiday they haven't, or the dishwasher not working, and you just think, oh, God, I spent 5 weeks there last year, so you spend 5 weeks with people who've got nothing, but they're happy. And that really plays tricks on your mind. It's an absolutely life-changing thing to go. Even just to go to Nepal is a life-changing thing to do.
I think you've got to seriously find a lot of things out about yourself, because like you said there, obviously there's a physical side of it, but the mental strength that you must need. You mentioned before as well about when you first started walking and climbing, taking yourself out on a Sunday, and you do that on your own. You mentioned about going away on your own as well, 2020. And there's a lot to be said about that. I think there's a lot of people now, we've got to do something with somebody. So they're heavily relying on doing something with somebody, where, you know, you find out a lot about yourself when you start doing things on your own, because you've just recently been alone as well, took yourself away,
yeah,
you know, for a few days over there. And I've spoken to people before. I've done solo trips, beach holiday, North Coast 500 campervan trip. And actually, you really find a lot out about yourself on those solo trips. But you just said you've met so many different people from different walks of life,
yeah,
that ultimately brings something back to you as well.
It does. And you find out, especially something like Global Nepal, that before you find out a lot out about yourself, you find out where you think your limits are, and then actually what your real limits are, both physically and mentally. It was a point of one of the big climbs we did. We were about up to go back with a bit. One of the first climbs we did on that trip, I had to bail out with the climb, let's just put it that way. I couldn't go on any further. I was mentally drained, physically drained. And when we got back down, my climbing guide told me that I was only 2 meters from the top. If I'd known that, I would have kept going. But I didn't know that at the time. And I just said, I did it once or twice. I just said, I really can't do that. What that forced me to do was the next four big fights I did, but bigger than that one, was to think, I can push beyond that. I must be able to push beyond this. The safety limits, obviously, you've got to think about. I thought I must be able to do the last one we did. We were in there was a point where those two was flying together on the guide, and we had to take five steps, literally five steps, stop for 30 seconds to breathe, and then take another five steps. As tough as that. And the amount of times both of us wanted to give up was incredible. But we both pushed on. We got to the top. Of course, you got a huge adrenaline rush when you get to the top. Loads of nice photographs and things. And then sort of think 200 meters before the top, we were just about finished. You get to the top, you get an adrenaline rush. We walked off 19 kilometers. But I was just about finished 200 meters. That's crazy. Because you think you're finished, but you have so much energy left in you. You've got to find a way through that physically, but it's also mentally. Mentally, it's massive. You think your legs are gone, but they're not actually gone. There's actually way more in you, provided you can convince yourself.
Well, it's also going back before as well. It's convincing yourself and having that mental strength, but it's having those people around you as well. Yeah. Come on, we can do this. You know, whether you're looking at it, you know, a new career, or you're looking at sport and achievement or a goal. You know, we kind of sometimes think you can't do that, and you spend more time telling yourself you can't do it, and you back out of it. Like, really, you know, you're 200 meters away of achieving your goals.
Yeah, it's part of the confidence thing we said, starting with confidence, about having the belief you can achieve something you want to achieve. And that a lot of times that comes down to planning and preparation, and using the stuff we did, and doing massive amounts of training, obviously, had all the right kit. All the right preparation, because you've got to have all that to make sure you can do something with it. And if you haven't prepared, you're already on a backward step in your mind, because you know as soon as you start doing something, it becomes difficult. You think to yourself, well, I haven't actually prepared properly. And so you start to fire out of it. If you prepared, if you have prepared properly and you know in your mind you've done everything you can do to prepare, that helps you go and see when you face the challenge. And that's just life, that's work, that's everything.
I love that, because sometimes, you know, I think maybe we're all guilty. I'm just going to say that there's a lot of people that, you know, this work that needs to go in. We don't, and especially now, with social media and, you know, people we follow, and there's a lot of, like, you know, where it's like, wait, I want to be on holiday, I want to be doing this, I want a camper, I want this car, I want this house, or whatever. Where you've got a bloody work towards it. You know, it just doesn't come along. So that prep work and putting the time and the effort in is key to achieving your goal.
I wonder as well how that, like, that failing is so called, where you give up the 2 or 3
net,
is also part of the prep in the bigger picture of things, because you have to kind of sometimes learn those lessons in order to then think, as you said, I'm not going to give up. But in other, it works in other areas, you know. So how much of the failures, so-called, have played into the growth of your confidence and self-belief?
Oh, huge. Because you learn from your mistakes in life. You really do.
Trying to go back, I could put that failure there, that client from the Bougie East. That's the only photograph on my desk. I've got thousands of photographs from the clients. That is the only photograph on my desk of me sitting, looking at totally dejected. On a rock with snow in the background, I can picture it now, and it sits there with me, because that drives me, because I know that day I could have done more and I didn't. And you learn from that through life. You've got to learn through that. We all make mistakes. If you don't make mistakes, you haven't tried all of them. And if you do that failure, you haven't tried all of them. And you've got to learn from them and learn how to get to them.
When did your leadership walk come about in that case? When it was that before actually you were climbing? At what stage? I really like this is something that which I'm really big on in terms of groups getting together. At what point did you decide to launch the leadership walks?
So I set that up about 2 years ago, I think. So I got a leadership on Music Walks Group on Facebook, and we plan and organise various walks. There's a friend of mine and I organise them. It started off something completely different to what it is now. And the reason it started was I was doing a lot of the consulting stuff with people in business. I normally go and see people in their office. So I sit in somebody's office and we talk about their business. Business is what I do. I went to see a couple of people who enjoyed walking and enjoyed being outdoors. So I said, why don't we go? It's a lovely day. Why don't we go for a walk instead of sitting in the office? Because I enjoy walking, they enjoy walking. Let's go and do that. And it worked so much better than sitting in the office because they were away from their emails. They were away from people locking on their office doors and looking them, working the telephone. Of course, we were out. It was a nice day. So you think differently. And we actually covered far more. So my initial thought was to set Leadership Walks up, to progress into that and do more of that for the businesses that I work with. Now I still want to do more of that. What it's sort of turned into is a group where people turn up and it's more of a social group. We were going to do different walks every week. Now on a Monday night, so I was out last night, we do the same walk just about every week. And the reason we do the same walk is I don't have to navigate, so I don't have to tell people to turn left or right here. Most people understand the route. And what then happens is people can talk more. We all get together, we talk about different subjects, and there's all sorts of things come out. We talked about the odd socks in the sock drawer last night, for instance. We talk about mental health stuff, we talk about challenges, we talk about work, we talk about food, biscuits, dogs, even if we talk about all sorts of things. But people come out, they get some exercise, and they have some social interaction. And you know, the feedback I have of some people is that it's changed their life by coming along and doing it. It saved them at various times through going through what they were going through. And it's turned into a really nice social group. I still had a plan to turn it into what I originally set up for, which I'll do in some time, but there's no worry to me. I'll do that in soon because it's good the way it is. And then what we do when we're out is we plan on a walk. So we agree what we're going to do. The Lake District walk in a couple of weeks' time, I'll do stop and walk. So we plan different challenges as well when we're over there.
I've talked about it so many times. I mean, that was a big shift change in my life. And I'd sort of, before COVID, walking, I pretty much religiously walked every Saturday for probably the last 5 years or so. And it just gives you time and like kind of go back to your Sunday walks. I've walked out on a Saturday morning, you know, quite anxious about certain things. I probably do on average about 10, 11 miles a week every Saturday, unless I've got something on, but I've got it in my diary on repeat. Yeah. And I always have done. And, you know, 3 hours later, 2.5 hours later, coming back with a clear mind. I mean, the difference, if you could gauge it in some way of putting some sensors on your mind or something like that, onto your head, but the difference coming back from the walk. You know, and again, I've done pretty much the same route. I do mix it up a little bit from a selfish point of view. I like to drink coffee along the way and stuff like that. But I think for me, I needed that time on my own first to do that. But certainly more and more now, you know, getting more involved with the group. So you can just having those conversations about biscuits and odd socks, you know, you might not have that. You might be having dishwasher arguments. With your partner or whoever, you know, you're getting that normal interaction. And you mentioned social before. That's physical, social interaction, yeah. Not just social media interaction, which is a goddamn long place sometimes. It's a time and a place.
Yeah.
But that physical interaction that you get.
Yeah. So last night, for about 3 hours, you know, we had the phones out, all the phones in the pocket, everybody's. And people mix around the group and chat with different people that have spoken before. It's also helped me a lot because I've got them planned in the diary.
Yeah.
So if it was maybe a wet Monday night and it was a bit cold, I'd be thinking, well, actually, I'll not go out for a walk tonight on my own. But because I've arranged to be 10 people and I'm leading the group, it forces me to go out as well. So I've got to tell. Now I've got to take people on a walk. So that forces me to get some exercise, even though sometimes I might not go. So,
you know, one of the things that's coming throughout everything you said, you know, the
connection with people, and then also taking yourself off on your own. But then we talked about loneliness before. It strikes me there's a big difference. I think it's really important to recognize the difference between loneliness, which you can feel anywhere with anybody, and solitude, and picking solitude as a deliberate act to have some time yourself. And it's really, really valuable. But then so is connection. So it's kind of almost deciding to what quantity and what extent needed at given time. Because there's been times where I'm like, well, I'll be more solitude. And then there's definitely now, let's say, connection is a big thing. So does that kind of resonate with what you say?
Yeah, I think it does, yeah. And there's sometimes solitude is really important to me, so I can get away on my own and think and find time and get away from some things, not escape things, just get away and go by that space. And there's other times where if I'm feeling lonely, I want to be around a lot of people and I don't want to be on my own. And I seriously don't want to be on my own. I'll find ways of making connections with people or having the diary so it's busier because I know I need to be around people. Yeah. There's a huge difference between the two.
Yeah. Yeah.
Solitude is something I think you choose to do and you want to be away. Loneliness is something that creeps up on you and you can be at the loneliest people in a busy road if you want to be. You can. I've been there, you can be lonely in a busy room. Well, that's a...
The next thing I want to touch on, because I've got to say, you're definitely one of the most lebanese guys I've ever met. Absolutely love your outfit, as usual. When did clothes come into your life? And I want to touch on it as well, because it's the clothes, but it's also the motorbikes, and it's also heavily involved with Distinguished Gentlemen as well. So when did your passion for clothes and bikes come along? How did that kind of, did that lead into Distinguished Gentlemen?
Yeah, the short answer is yes. So the backstory is I've got two older sisters, both heavily into clothes and shoes and fashion when they were younger and still are. One of them was a fashion shop and their own boutique. The other one's involved in retail as well, not in clothes, but in something else. And I think as well, my father was always shirt and tied. Even when he retired on a Sunday, he'd go and sing. He wasn't going in, he was just going to the garden, but he's always immaculate. He turned out, always was. And I think I just grew up with that. And sisters had shoes everywhere, so I ended up with a love for shoes, ended up with a love for clothes. And then I think very early days, I was a punk. So in my formative years, I was an absolute out and out punk. All sorts of fashion around being punk, red leopard skin trousers, bright red blazers, tight hairs in those days. And it was a real statement and I liked it. That progressed into getting into business again. I'll go about the business side. You had to dress appropriately for work in those days. People have all sorts of styles at work. However, in those days, if you went to see a customer, you always wore a smart suit, you had a shirt and tie, and you always immaculately turned out. And I like that, and I like the confidence that gave you as well, because you knew if you were well turned out, you'd get a bit more respect, especially as a young man in a managerial role. If I turned up in a t-shirt and jeans, I probably would have got a different reaction than turned up in a suit. So it sort of lived with me through all my life. Motorbikes, I had them when I was 16. When I was an apprentice, I had a moped, but we rode the bigger and faster motorbikes. I then transformed those into bigger and faster cars because I couldn't take ladies out on a bike very well, so I'll have a car. And I went out of motorbikes for a while, and I deliberately kept motorbikes out of my life, even though I loved them when my kids were little, because I didn't want my kids getting involved in motorbikes because they're extremely dangerous. So I stayed away from them, still loved them, dabbled with them, but when the kids grew up, I thought, that passed all of this and get motorbikes again. So I did. And got three, which I love. The old classic one, electric super, and another one, the modern bike. Funny enough, my son has now, just 2 years ago, decided to take the motorbike license, and he's now got a motorbike as well. So him and I go out riding together, which is lovely. So we'll just, on a Saturday afternoon, pop out for half an hour, go and have a coffee somewhere, and just ride out together, which is a really nice thing to do together. We don't ride fast at that, so we just take our time and be sensible about it. That then transformed into something called Distinguished Gentlemen's Ride, which takes place all around the world. I can't remember how many cities, but a lot of cities around the world. It's a big charitable event for men's health, and it raises millions every year. It's the same day every year. Sorry, it's the same day around all those cities once a year. Everybody gets dressed up in distinguished clothes, dapper clothes, and we ride classic motorbikes or motorbikes, and we all ride around the city. So this year in Newcastle, there's over 300 rooms out, which is a fabulous sight to see because everyone's on different motorbikes. Nobody's riding fast. It's what I call the gentleman's part of motorbike. And people have some people have an impression of what motorbikes and bikers are. They're not all like that. And we all go out. We go for a social ride out together. We stop in a couple of places, have a chat about motorbikes and clothes and all sorts of things. We then go back and have a burger at the end. And we had an event this year. It's a lovely day. It's one of my favorite days of the year. Fortunately, the weather's normally nice as well. So we do it in May, so the weather's normally quite nice. And as a result of that, there's a few of us get together now and then. We all go out riding, we go to different events, and we don't go out in letters and things. We go out dressed up and go to different events. It's a nice thing to do. People react differently. People thought we were all going to the wedding. When we were out the last time, I thought, well, after some wedding, we were all dressed up small on motorbikes and we just went for a nice ride out. It's a lovely thing.
Wedding bikes is already in there.
Definitely, yes.
So you've got a couple of accessories on that are orange.
Yeah.
Where has that come from? Where's the orangeness? Because I've been here before with training kit. I had a spell where I was wearing orange trainers, orange kit. I'm just interested. I picked up on it before. Where's that love and passion of orange come from?
Orange started from Alzheimer's research.
Okay.
So my father died without Alzheimer's 6 years ago. And I've done a lot of charity events for Alzheimer's. Their standard colours are orange. And as a result, they give you an orange or orange and white t-shirt. So I end up buying an orange pair of shorts, an orange pair of trainers to match. And that all formed into orange. It's always been one of my favourite colours.
Orange woven kit?
Absolutely. Everything is orange woven kit. Absolutely. Orange boots, orange jackets, orange everything. It's quite a nice kit, but snow anyway, and for the hills, because you get observed in orange, that's very useful anyway, and it just transformed into this little orange, and so everything has an orange touch to it. So I rebuilt, or one of my friends rebuilt for me, a classic motorbike, and I was deciding what colour to do with it. It's an old BMW, and there's a fantastic BMW Fire Orange, which is a really bright orange. So we did it in modern BMW colour, and the classic bike, and it's a really standard bike.
Just see, you pick up there on the obviously the mental health side of things with distinguished gentlemen's bike rides. Just know we've talked, we caught up a couple of weeks ago, and you've had some big changes in your life over the last couple of months that I want to touch on. What I'm really keen to understand is a little bit about those things. Well, for everybody as well, because we talk openly about some of the challenges we've had, our guests have as well, and their coping mechanisms, because I think it's very important for guys to hear different walks of life. And even if there's like one bit that just resonates with somebody, so just have one person out. So if you can just talk through the sort of last 3 months.
Okay. First of all, I should say, I understand mental health. I've been around mental health. I think I've been struggling with mental health. I've never really appreciated it until the last few months. I've had in my life, I've always been a positive chap. I've always had, I guess, an upbeat personality, a positive personality. However, I have had my days where I've been like a 3 out of 10, or I've been having a bad day, 2 out of 10. I've always found my own coping mechanisms. So I've decided to do something about it. So my thought always was, which is very naive, a remedies now that I think about it, if I can do that, why can't everybody else do that? So I used to think, get yourself out of it. I can find ways out of my bad days, why can't you? Given the last few months, after horrible thought. So just less than 3 months ago, I was climbing on Ben Nevis. I came down from Ben Nevis. I felt fine. That's had a great deal in the morning. That being up for the sunset, took some amazing pictures. Came back down, sat in the camper van, having a cup of coffee, and I felt really lightheaded. long story short, I was having a heart attack and I didn't know. I rang some, rang 111 or whatever it was. They diagnosed this paramedic service. You were like in the hospital. In the back of the ambulance, I was absolutely petrified. And I mean petrified because, first of all, I realized I haven't told anybody that I had this. So all my loved ones at the time didn't know I was having a heart attack. And I realized I was dying. And I thought, I haven't told anybody about this. Shit. I then had, which is the real bizarre about this, which you don't, the mental health stuff, I had a beautiful, and I mean a beautiful 30 seconds where I actually floated and all my, people say a life flashes before you, but I had a beautiful moment where I thought, actually, literally, you know, as you're going to die, so you've had a great life. Just be pleased with it. And that went right through my head. Next thing I know, I'm lying on a hospital bed, getting a stent put in my arm, which I was awake watching the operation. Fabulous experience to watch, by the way, really impressive. Guy operated on me, 20 minutes later, I'm sitting on the cup of tea and slice of toast like this, back to normal, which was bizarre as hell. And I stayed in hospital in Scotland for a few days. I've always been what I used to describe as life's too short. I used to describe as that life's too short. Live every day, the best you can live, all that type of stuff. I always be a bit like that anyway. The bizarre bit was, the next day when I woke up, my first thought was, bloody hell, this is a bonus day because I should be dead. I could have died yesterday. I'm actually alive. So today is a bonus day. Every day now is a bonus day. The really bizarre bit was, I realized the day before that when I nearly died, it was actually quite nice. So it played a real trick on my mind and still does every day now, where I think to myself, actually dying isn't a bad thing because I'm now not fine with it. I don't want to die, by the way. But it made me think it's actually not a bad thing. I'm not frightened of it. So every day I go through, it's a bonus day. And I'm all right being here. But actually, life's very precious. And it's become more and more precious. And then, as a result of that, so I came back, went to cardio rehab. And I have to say, NHS was superb, absolutely superb. The after-sales service they give you on a heart attack is the best thing in the world. They find the psychiatrist help because a lot of people go through the same thoughts I've been through. So you get professional help. They also take you through what I call old man's umbra. So I do sorts of exercise classes, and I couldn't, the first, bear in mind prior to that, I was running all over the place doing half marathons and things and climbing mountains. I did a 1 hour cardio rehab class. I had to go home and sleep for 2 hours. That's how much it affected me. Went through all sorts of things emotionally as a result of all of that. A few weeks later, I split up with a girlfriend at the time. We'd been together 5 years. Actually, we loved her, and the two of us decided to split up. It was amicable. We decided to split up. That was really difficult to deal with at the time. And then, because you're going through all sorts of emotional thoughts at the same time, you hear about things that happen during the relationship, or that people send you all sorts of strange texts and things. Social media is horrendous. You get all sorts of comments and things via social media. A couple of things happened just days later, which, because of the way I was thinking, I thought would be horrendously cruel to me. You don't understand other people's motives. You can't control other people's motives. All you think about is, that's happening to me. Why the hell is this happening to me when I least need this? I'm going through all sorts at this moment in time. Why are you being cruel to me? And some of those things will haunt me for a while, but it puts you under tremendous stress. As a result of it, I went into a really dark place, a really, really dark place. I'm the lowest I've felt in my life, I think. And it was really difficult to deal with. I have to say, I mentioned before, I've got some great people around me, two sisters who are fabulous, some friends I've had some school days who've been superb, who without me even saying it, knew what I was going through, they could tell. Took me off to different places, took me away for a weekend, spent time with me, rang me loads of times, just talked to me. One of my friends went walking with me for a day, just trying to get me back to where I was. Some other people who I'd known through the relationship were also absolutely fabulous and got in touch and helped me through all of that as well, and helped me understand it better. And also helped me understand other people's perspectives. You could only think about your own. You don't try to understand other people who notice and just think people are doing things to me. You're in a dark place. But actually, people are doing things for their own reasons, for their own benefits, and they've got their own world as well. And so they helped me understand all that. So having great people around me helped. Professional help helped enormously. So I got some professional help that I needed to. And they broke the cycle. They broke the horrible thoughts that were in my head at the time. And they helped me snap out of it. Slowly and gradually, and people made some really strange statements like, the day after this happens, you've gone through a heart attack, you've gone through all sorts of changes in your life, you've gone through a relationship breakdown. And the next day, people send me messages like, just move on. Well, that's easy to say. Yeah, thanks for that. That's easy to say, just move on. Yeah, I'll tell you what, I'll just move on like that. You can't just move on like that. Well, some people might.
Or is more fish in the sea?
take your pick.
Yeah. Just move on. Don't worry. Time will make it better. You'll be all right. There's plenty more fish in the sea. Da 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 da. And you know, if you've been in love with somebody, which I was, to move on like in 2 seconds is really difficult. But people make and those statements hit you really hard. So we only want the coping mechanism, nothing from there. So I went through all that, and it was really difficult. So I got some professional help. I had great help around me from people who were helping. I then decided I really need to change things. So one of the first, So part of the heart attack, I'm on drugs for life. We end up with a load of drugs. The drugs make you think all sorts of things as well. So they compound all of this, and they make your emotions swing massively. I haven't really been a huge emotional swing person, but I have been since I've been taking the drugs. I also wake up, which is quite strange, with poems in my head just about every day. And I know
I'm writing them.
I am writing them. And I've written a few of them. And there'll be like 24 lines of a poem, and every word is there when I wake up. So just did it. And it's quite strange. And I can write the whole thing straight down without even thinking about it. So
I'm in a huge, huge journey to the end. And I'm like almost like an explosion of lots of things happening at the same time. What have you learned? You said you went to a dark place. That kind of suggested maybe you coming out or moving out. But what have you learned about yourself in terms of how you handle that now? What have you learned in terms of coping strategies?
So I should say, first of all, I'm a hell of a lot better place than I was a few weeks ago. A whole house as well. I should be living it together. And you learn different ways of dealing with things. Apart from the poems I talked about before, what I've started doing a hell of a lot is journaling things. I write things down every day. And the reason I write things down, which is advised I should do, is what makes me feel worse, what makes me feel better. Sounds dead simple. So I write those down every day, how I'm feeling in the morning, how I'm feeling at night, what did you appreciate about today, what was bad about today. And I look back on them and quite simply do more of the stuff I enjoy and do less of the stuff that sends me the wrong way. Drinking is great at the time, so alcohol's great in that moment in time. We obviously wake up the next morning and it sends you backwards. So I reduce that, reduce what I'm doing with that. Social media, I mentioned before some of the stuff that happened with social media and some of the interaction people make. Cut myself off from a hell of a lot of social media. Reduced my following on social media and reduced my output. Sometimes when I put stuff out, people have a reaction to it. So I'm very guarded in what I put out. I'll put some nice photographs out on Instagram, but I'll try to get rid of some of the sarcasm I used to have on social media, fearful of the reaction I might get. Back into running again. I'm back into fitness again because I have to take time off and see with the heart attack and build that up slowly. So I'm back into running again. Planning that in my diary so it becomes a priority. It's huge for me. Running again, walking again. I talked before about going out on social walks with people and spending time with people who are good for me and not spending time with people who are not good for me. Changed my work a bit. Even some of the people I worked with, I've stopped working with because it was becoming frustrating. And back to life's too precious, why do I need that? So I've changed some of that as well. And changed the way I think about things. You know, a big thing for me is you can't control what people do. I've never really been a control freak. You can't control what people do. You can't control what they say and how they act. What you can do is control how you react to it and trying to pause and stop and think rather than reacting to something and trying to think, what are they really trying to do? What's their motive for that? Or also just try to ignore it. It's very important. And think about it differently. Try and think about things from people's perspective, but also think about it differently. And just make sure that you learn from it. To go back to the relationship thing, I'm no angel. I know I'm no angel in the relationship. And I did some things in that relationship that I should have done a lot better. Still vanishing off the other side of the world for 5 weeks was not a great thing to do in a relationship, especially if I'd just been away 3 weeks, 3 weeks before that, for 3 weeks. That's not a great way to run a relationship. I should have done things different in that relationship, and I should have changed the way I've done things in the relationship, and I regret some of those, but I can't change them. I can't go back and change them all now. That's done. All I can do is learn from them. So the next time I'm in a relationship, I'll approach it differently, and I'll approach it better based on what I've learned from that. And that's, we'll go back to what we talked about in life before. All you can really do with things is learn from them, because things happen to you in life. Some are intended, some are unintended, but all you actually do is manage how you react to it and how you learn from it. And I think if I could wind time back and stop myself getting to where I got to throughout all of that, I would have talked to people a lot earlier. I didn't seek out people to talk to. Friends and people close to me and loved ones came to help me because they realized I needed it. I should have stopped and realized myself that I needed it, but I didn't.
I think that's quite hard on yourself because, I have similar experiences where I look now and I would hope that I've learned enough to not make the same mistakes again. We talked earlier on about mistakes in business and around friends and in other relationships, but it's really taken that on board and thinking, like, okay. It's hard getting two people together in a relationship. It's easy enough saying, well, I shouldn't have done this and I shouldn't have done that. And I think until you realize that the mistakes or things that we could do differently and improve, that big realization, and that takes some doing as well. I think there's a bit of pride in there as well. And to put your hands up sometimes, that's a big step. What people don't, they'll just keep on same thing over and over with the same outcome.
Yeah. So, when you said about the control things that, that you can control and you only bunch your lights down. It's like, one of the things you said earlier that ties in with, the running on a wall and or you'd think climbing in, it sounded like that was a big part of that process. What is a particular way that you set up your thinking for the day ahead that you've learned since?
Yeah, so I'm back with the running thing. I know it's important to me, so I prioritize it. It goes in the diary before anything else. And it very rarely gets moved unless there's something really important happens. But even simple things like if I'm going for a run on Tuesday morning, on a Monday night before I go to bed, I roll my running kit out so it's ready. So that avoids the excuse when you get up in the morning and spending 2 minutes looking for your running kit, which then turns into, oh, that's actually a bit cool, I might not go today, and you put it off. Just simple things. They sound really simple, but and they're minor things, but they're really important. Because they change something in your brain, which makes you go and do things. I listen to audiobooks whenever I run all the time. And the audiobooks I listen to are normally about serious mountain challenges that people have done. So when I'm running, I'm thinking my knees are a bit sore. I'm listening to some guy who's about to die on the middle of the mountain. So instead, you just think, well, actually, I'm chilling my knees on that. So just keep going. It's all about programming your brain to do different things.
Mostly. Yeah, I love that. It's that idea you react or you learn to respond, but you're also preparing yourself for what might come at the end. Yeah. And that program, that self-talk, sounds like it's really important.
We've put a lot of preparation before for all sorts of things, but challenges and things. And I think you can prepare yourself for life events if you know they're going to happen. And also, if you've been through them before, you've got some experience. In work, I can spot things in work and in businesses now that have happened before, and you can see them coming, so you can prepare for them and put things in place ready in advance to stop them happening or to be ready for them when they do happen. You can do the same in life if you know they're coming, and also if you've had them before. If you haven't had them before and it's a brand new experience, it's a brand new experience, and you've got to learn on the spot. And learn on the spot is about how I'm going to react to this, what I'm going to do, how I'm going to get around this, and helping our plan and everything else.
All of that.
You do. I think I'd like to just move on to the final question now, which we ask all our guests. And it's about what products or thing from your childhood or earlier on in life do you have some nostalgia with that really still sticks out in your mind and have you still got?
In terms of clothing and the likes, yeah.
Anything. It doesn't necessarily have to be clothing.
I think there's a few things that made me confident in around clothing and life. And if I can go back to one of the things I loved when I was younger, and people started wearing them again, I had a pair of Doug Marie's. And I went to a coffee shop the other day, and the two people behind the counter both had Doug Marie's on, and I thought, they looked really cool. And so I said to the girl who served my coffee, they look great with Doug Marie's. I used to have a pair, and she said, well, you should get some. And I said, no, because I look like somebody at the kids' TV show that already Doug Marie's in my ears. So I'll definitely not get some Doug Marie's. But I loved them at the time, and they gave me loads of coffee. So I went out with them. I thought they were great. Now I guess it's shoes. There's always been a big thing for me. Always, I think it could stem us from growing up with two sisters who also have lots of, probably still have, by the way, lots of shoes. But there was always lots of shoes around the house. And shoes made a bit of an outfit for me, and they always do. I was away last week, and I've found those.
Oh, wow.
Which are, I've got a few pair of trainers. I looked at those once or twice and thought, Mitchell, you can't wear those.
They're spectacular.
Actually decided to buy them, and I bought them the other night, and they were lovely, and they're just lovely.
Just hold them up for the camera just so everybody can see.
Adidas Campus Big Trippers.
Fantastic.
And actually, one last thing is I brought that in as well. Aftershave. I've worn all sorts of aftershaves in my life. And I used to even have, I think, work aftershave. So it was a cheap aftershave. That I kept some I kept in the car. And I've decided, why am I doing that? If there's one I really like, which I like, wear it all the time. So I do. So I stop buying cheap aftershaves. I buy aftershaves that I like. It smells really nice. And to me, that gives me some confidence as well. It always smells right.
I think it's two things that I get. And what I love, since I said what's about it, there's definitely two things which I get people call those on the streets. One's what I'm wearing, and the other's how it smells. And for me, the two massive confidence boosters.
Yeah.
So I'm wishing on that one.
What fascinates me is that with these things right from childhood, this is why this question I think is so relevant. It might seem a bit off the wall for confidence and energy, but it's so relevant because it often goes back to the things from our childhood or formative years, you know, something, an object, a bag or shoes, like still means something.
Yeah.
And the big thing is, are you still doing that? Are you still got it in life now? And you've got your shoes and you have the shoes. It's just awesome. Love it.
Yeah. Well, thanks for your time, Mitchell. It's been fantastic to spend some time with you. They were all about hearing your experience as well. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you. It's really cathartic and lovely to do. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Cheers. I hope that you enjoyed the episodes and got something from that. If you did, we would love you to share our podcast.
And if you're not already, subscribe to the show and leave us a rating and a review. That really helps spread the word.
We'd also like to thank our podcast producer, Bernardo, for doing a sensational job.
And thanks to the awesome Logan Nicholson of musicthemakers.com for the music for the podcast. Catch you in the next episode.
Thanks, guys.